You know, some of the sessions you probably noticed for the marriage reconciliation are pretty basic. In other words, they're material you've gone over, probably have taught many times in your own counseling ministry. There's a few sessions that they really wanted to ensure that everybody had the basics down. And then there's also some sessions like this one that are a little trickier. And I want to try to address the matters not only from within a single church, but also try to address how we might handle it when we're counseling somebody from another church. Because I think many of us would have the opportunity to serve a person from another ministry. And so how do we navigate these kinds of challenges? I want to say from the start that this is not just an academic subject for some of us. Some of us have been touched by this issue in one way, shape, or form. And I want you to know that while we're talking about this today from an academic point of view, there's a lot of ministry here. It's not just an academic subject, it's a pastoral subject. It's a how to handle difficulty in life subject. And so if you've experienced some of that, then I'm just going to ask that you grant grace that we're not trying to counsel a specific situation. We're trying to look at a subject matter and think about some of the process elements that might fit in. Okay, our task is to deal with these divorce and remarriage stuff. And they're challenging because they have some practical as well as some theological issues. And we're going to look at several ways to address them. You know, we get into this spot because people are choosing to walk in some really bad paths. Think, for example, you have a guy whose wife berates him, puts him down. You serve him as best you can, but what do you say when he says, "Do I have grounds for divorce?" Or you have a woman who comes to you and she's crying. Her husband hasn't committed adultery, but he's mean and he's cruel. She regularly experiences criticism and on occasion experiences some really difficult circumstances. Like she goes to the grocery store because her husband asks her to, but before she gets there, her husband cancels the credit card. So that way, when she arrives at the cash register, she now has the task of learning that her card was stolen, the cashier takes it, and now she's got to figure out what to do. What are you going to say to her when she says, "Do I have grounds for divorce?" I mean, you might ask about adultery, and the answer is no, and you ask about a physical altercation, and the answer is no, and you ask, well, does he go to strip clubs or massage parlors, and the answer is no. In other words, the simple ones are out. And so what do you do? Do you suggest that that person has grounds or not? And I found that the level of sinful creativity is both surprising and discouraging. It's amazing what some people will end up doing. Now, you have an exam to take. And so you need to know some of these options and what they're called and who supports them, because it's part of the exam that you have. So you're going to have to hang on to these options carefully, even if you don't agree with them. It doesn't really matter which one you hold in terms of the exam. It matters that you know them all and who supports them. So no divorce, no remarriage is one option. John Piper is the one who defends this probably most vehemently in the book, This Momentary Marriage. But others, like Heath Lambert, who is the former ACBC executive director, holds this view. Russell Moore. So there have been others, and there have been people historically who have as well. You must endure. You must rely on the sufficiency of Christ in the midst of your deepest hurts and struggles. And if you think about it, this view does have some sense to it. Can you imagine a person coming to you and saying, Well, I want to divorce my wife because she was involved in a car accident and it's changed who she is. And so the person that I'm married to now is not the person who I agreed to marry 25 years ago. I think most of us would be appalled at that question. However, there are people asking questions like that. Imagine a married person who learns that their spouse has cancer and requires care, only to give up and say they'd rather be doing something fun. A young couple eagerly await the birth of their first child. When the day arrives, they learn that their child has Down syndrome, so this child will never care for themselves, leave home, attend a regular classroom, and they'll have tremendous needs throughout their entire life. So the man decides he doesn't want to do this and leaves. Now, I think under each of these cases, we would say how awful that is. And we're going to justify it how? No grounds for divorce, right? The number of these scenarios is practically endless. And it becomes hard to wrestle with some really tricky questions. So option number one is you just say, here's the deal. No. No divorce, no remarriage. And you look at the passages of Scripture and you handle them all and you interpret them all under that framework. That's one option. A second option is called the patristic view. And the exam will use some of those kinds of words. It means that there are some provisions for divorce, but there is not provision for remarriage. And that means outside of the death of a spouse. So if we're talking the death of a spouse, then even those who hold this view would say that person is free. So the covenant only exists as long as both individuals are alive. But this is called the patristic view because many of the church fathers held to it. So they would argue that there might be possibilities for divorce, and there could, in fact, be remarriage if the remarriage was back to the former spouse or if the spouse died. However, there is no remarriage outside of those conditions. That would be their position. So ministry to these persons would say that, yes, you're allowed to divorce, but no, you are not allowed to remarry. So you can imagine the kinds of conversations that we would have in the counseling room. As you tell a mom with four kids that she can pursue divorce because of her husband's unfaithfulness, but she can never remarry. Option number three. This is called the Erasmian view, probably the one that is most popular. This is divorce and remarriage in certain circumstances. So the people who would hold to this would be like the Westminster Confession, John MacArthur, as well as many, many others, probably the mainstream view. So this view is both the most comfortable and the most uncomfortable position to hold. Because it's the most comfortable in the sense that it allows a certain amount of flexibility. You don't have to tell the mom with four kids that she can divorce but never remarry. You don't have to tell the wife that she's stuck despite her husband's adultery. You don't have to tell the husband whose wife ran off with another man that he cannot divorce her. But the reason that it's so uncomfortable is what qualifies as immorality, or what qualifies as abandonment. So if a wife says that her husband refuses to give up his pornography, does she have grounds for divorce? What do you say to a woman whose husband committed adultery one time, genuinely repented, but she cannot imagine life with him ever again? Is she free or is